From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart.
Frank Sinatra has had as many books written about him as Abraham Lincoln, Hitler, or the Beatles. Some of them have been pretty good, but there has not been a definitive biography that does justice to the man and the artist. Until now. James Kaplan has done the job, at least the first half of it. Frank, the voice, covers Sinatra's rise and fall and rise again, strips away the myth and legend to reveal a legendary performer of mythical proportions. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
I'm honored to be here, Gary. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we spoke with Gary Giddens a few weeks ago here on From the Bookshelf, and he wrote his first volume on Bing Crosby in 2003, and he promises volume two in a year or so. So now I've known you for 5 years since you wrote your Jerry Lewis book, and you've been working on this Frank Sinatra book that whole time. So how long are we going to have to wait for volume two?
I like to think, I won't tell you a year or so, but I like to think that it will take me a little less long to do Volume 2 than it did to do Volume 1, simply because I've done a lot of the research already for Volume 2, done a substantial amount of the interviewing, and one of the most difficult things for Volume 1 was finding my voice, finding the style in which I would tell the story.
Well, you definitely did that, and a lot of has been made in the press. I'm sure you're very happy with the reviews the book has gotten, but a lot of has been made about your voice as a novelist, a novelist's approach to writing the book. And I'll tell you, the novel that it reminds me of is Gone with the Wind. Mm. Not just for sheer length, but and I sort of see Frank Sinatra is Scarlett O'Hara, and Ava Gardner. Ava Gardner is Rhett Butler, and or Ashley Wilkes, and Nancy Sinatra is Rhett Butler, maybe. I don't know, but just that sort of epic saga of love. But at the same time, your book doesn't linger on those gossipy aspects of the story, as other books have. You talk a lot about the music and the art and all that. And as I was saying, there have been a couple of other good books on Sinatra, and you quote a bit from all the good ones and a couple of the lousy ones. One of my favorites is Sinatra by Robin Douglas Home from 1962, and you took a part of the Nelson Riddle quote from that book, I believe. But so what was your goal in tackling Sinatra? I mean, he's been written about a lot, so...
Yeah, I actually Jerry Lewis had a lot to do with my taking on Sinatra, because the book I did with Jerry Lewis stemmed from a New Yorker profile I wrote of him in 2000, and for the profile we spent many hours interviewing in chiefly in his office in Las Vegas, his home office, in his house, and which, as you might imagine, is carpeted with bright red carpet and filled with memorabilia. And one of the many pictures on the wall was a photograph of Jerry Lewis and Frank Sinatra, both in tuxedos, and Jerry is wrestling Frank to the ground. It was taken at, I think, the 1962 Oscars. Sinatra is laughing. Jerry has one of those demonic faces on that only he can put on. And I don't know whether he's tickling Sinatra or just wrestling him to the ground. But Jerry talked very frequently about Sinatra, always by his first name, because they were close and they worked together and they were friends. When we were finishing up the book, which also required lots of interviews, I went. Jerry invited me to the 2004 telethon, and it, which was in L.A. that year. And I went out to dinner one night with a bunch of musicians who were working on the telethon. And it was an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica. Lots of food, lots of booze, and we all got very happy. And I was just there as a guy, not a journalist. Anyway, it turned out, as we got to talking, that every one of these musicians had worked with Frank Sinatra. And you know musicians. Musicians are very plain-spoken people, meaning they are blunt. They tell it like it is. And I almost suspected that with a few drinks under their belt, they might begin the stories about the women and the fistfights and the mob. But instead, every one of these guys was talking in tones of real awe about what a musical genius Sinatra was. Well, we kind of knew that. I mean, I guess we knew that, but that's not certainly not how he had been written about. And I thought, what if, what about doing a book, because it was getting time for me to do my next book, what about doing a book that got the genius on the page? And as a bonus, what about doing a book of empathy about Sinatra, where you could feel what it was like to be this incredibly complex and inconvenient genius?
Well, let's talk a little bit about what makes him a genius. I mean, I love Perry Como. He's great. Why Sinatra, not Perry Como? What is the difference?
I love Perry Como too. You know, I am old enough to remember Catch a Falling Star and Put It in Your Pocket. And that was I think that song and Volare by Dean Martin were the two great songs of happiness of my childhood. I just remember those songs with such intense happiness. Sinatra's, I guess, essentially, Gary, it took me 786 pages to figure that out. So much of it has to do with the complexity of the personality, with the difficulty and the fury of his life. And as I assessed it, so much of it had to do with his mother, with Dolly Sinatra.
Well, she was an interesting person in his life. She's not on every page of the book. There's, at one point I realized, wow, he hasn't talked about Dolly in a while. Where does she go? They had a period where they didn't speak for a couple of years?
They had a very problematic relationship. He said to Shirley MacLaine in later life, my mother was a pisser. I never knew whether she was going to hug me or hit me. And indeed, there was a bat, like a policeman's baton, behind the bar at Marty O'Brien's Tavern in Hoboken, at 4th and Garden Streets, behind the bar there was a bat. And when Frank got out of line, which I think was pretty often, by Dolly's estimation anyway, she'd smack him. She also, one time when she got mad at him, pushed him down a flight of stairs, knocking him unconscious. Another time, held him under the waves at the Jersey Shore. I mean, this was a mother who was filled with fury, her own fury, her own. She was filled with fire and spirit. She was brilliant. She was tiny. She was she was greedy. When Frank got rich and famous, she wanted some. She wanted some all the time. And even when he was down and out, she hit him up for money. He bought her houses. He bought her fur coats. He bought her all kinds of things, and she never quite seemed to be satisfied.
We're talking with James Kaplan, and his new book is Frank, the Voice. Frank Sinatra, by the way. For those of you who don't know, just from Frank. Well, let's look at the pantheon. There's Al Jolson, was kind of the first popular vocalist in America, and then came Crosby, and Crosby brought something to it that Jolson hadn't, although Jolson was really good at making a contact with the audience and singing in a voice that was a natural voice, to the extent that it wasn't an operatic voice.
And never forget Zelda Fitzgerald's great comment about Al Jolson. She called him great. She said to her husband Scott Fitzgerald, "Isn't Al Jolson greater than Jesus?" She said.
Well, I'm sure Jolson thought so.
he was not. He didn't hide his light under a bushel, old Al. Jerry Lewis knew Al Jolson, by the way. And Crosby came along and brought something else that Al Jolson, you're right, brought a tremendously winning voice, a very a joyous voice, really, that people could really. It wasn't a distanced voice. It wasn't proper and operatic. What Crosby brought along was even more directness. It was almost a conversational voice. It was the voice of so many of the crooners, the Russ Columbos, the Rudy Valleys, sang in these artificially high tenor voices, and many of them with affected accents. Crosby came, and Jolson, to in his own way used a black accent. Now Crosby was not immune from that, but Crosby really just communicated so directly with the listener. And there was little Frankie Sinatra, the spoiled only child of Dolly and Marty, in his own bedroom in Hoboken, New Jersey, with his own cathedral model Philco radio, listening to Crosby and thinking, "I can do that."
Now, Crosby brought romance to the music, which is pretty much absent from Jolson's style. I mean, he had mostly songs about Mammy and April Showers and all that kind of stuff, and which are great. I mean, I love those records. But you know, Crosby was singing more in your ear, and lots of songs about love. And, in fact, many songs that Sinatra later recorded, like What's New, for instance, were originally Bing Crosby records. And after Sinatra came the kind of raw sexuality that we saw with Elvis Presley. But what role does sex play in Sinatra's performance?
I think it's in every molecule of his performance. He was it's going to sound maybe a little dime store psychological, but it's certainly the thesis of my book, that the uncertainty of his relationship with his mother and the constant suspense there. They say that men's relationships with women are very strongly conditioned on the relationship with the mother, and certainly Sinatra brought to his relationships with the many, 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 many women he spent time with something of that that uncertainty, of that need to impress, the constant need to impress. He was, from his adolescence, and certainly once he began singing as a career, just an intensely sexual man. Women threw themselves at him. It wasn't the same with Crosby. It's not that Crosby never had romances, but what Crosby did not have was Bobby Soxers. Crosby's success was a success of the Depression, his first success. It was a population without money he was singing to. When Frank's audience came along, while he was still singing with Dorsey, the Depression was over, the war was on, the teenagers of America had a couple of nickels to rub together, and they could afford to buy records. And suddenly there was this whole mass of teenage girls who were primed and ready for Frank Sinatra.
And was that, you know, when Presley came along, adults were outraged that their children were listening to this black music. Were people outraged, were adults outraged that people were listening to unwholesome Frank Sinatra? Was that the view?
It largely had to do with the swooning, and also it had to do with a few things. Listen, Crosby, whatever you make of Crosby, Crosby was whiter than Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra was an Italian American in a time in America when Italian Americans were not legally considered white. They were a minority, and all kinds of offensive adjectives were thrown at Italian Americans, and certainly at Sinatra, things like oily and all the rest you can imagine. Sinatra pushed a lot of buttons. He was driving these these girls wild. He was stirring them up in a way that Crosby had never stirred up the female population of America, and certainly the younger female population of America, and creating these scenes and these sensations to the point where the FBI began to investigate Sinatra just because he was whipping up the masses of girls.
And more so women than men liked him in the early part of your book.
Well, the early part of his career, don't forget, his career really takes off right smack in the middle of World War II. And as the boys are going off to fight around the world, and in 1942, just as he is leaving Dorsey, the war is going very badly for America. We're getting our butts kicked all across the Pacific. Terrible defeats. It wasn't really until 1943 that things began to turn around. But there's Sinatra singing these ballads of yearning, which were eagerly seized upon by America and mainly, you're right, the women of America, yearning for the boys who had gone away. But the paradox is Sinatra had not gone away, and he was, in fall of 1943, classified 4F to the great suspicion of many people. A lot of the rumor floated very strongly that he had bribed the draft physician $40,000 to be classified 4F. I think he genuinely had a punctured eardrum. He was his face and his ear were very badly damaged at birth, and also when he had a mastoid operation. But he could never avoid that opprobrium that settled on him during World War II. William Manchester, the terrific writer, the terrific chronicler of the Marines in the Pacific during World War II, who was also a decorated Marine himself, fought in the South Pacific, said that Sinatra was the most hated man in the armed forces.
There's a new memoir by David Eisenhower about his grandfather, President Eisenhower, and Eisenhower apparently, according to this book, refused to meet Sinatra in the early 60s because Sinatra had not served.
Yeah, well, and Eisenhower was a soldier. He was a soldier through and through. Even though he did give that great speech about the military-industrial complex, he was always a soldier, and yes, Sinatra had not served. Then again, neither did John Wayne. I would wager that Eisenhower would have gladly met with John Wayne.
Right, so it's probably more of the, including the possible gang ties and the Italian and American nature and all that stuff.
Yeah, so Sinatra brought many of his problems on himself. The argument could be made that the tabloids and the right wing columnists of America really lifted his public profile, if not always his career.
Now, when Crosby came along, technology played a role in his success because the microphone replaced the megaphone, and that allowed Crosby to sing in a more natural kind of quiet voice. Technology also was part of the success of Frank Sinatra.
Yes, the argument has been put forward that the riddle is always what was Frank Sinatra's instrument? People say his voice, and the answer is no, you're wrong. His instrument was the microphone. The microphone allowed him to sing, to communicate with his, again, predominantly female audience in the most intimate way. And there have been scientific studies done that show that women are particularly attracted to and affected by the specific tone of a man's voice. It is a sexual stimulant for women, and it certainly was to Sinatra's audience. Well, it wouldn't have been so stimulating if he had. And by the way, very early in his career, when he was a teenager, he did sing through a megaphone because he couldn't afford a microphone. And teenage boys used to throw pennies through the megaphone while he was singing. But that microphone, he had the greatest bedroom voice of all time. It's been discussed for decades how many thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, of babies were conceived to the sound of Frank Sinatra.
And when we think of the concept album, you know, we always think of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but in The Voice, you point out that not only did Sinatra make long-playing concept albums a decade before the Beatles, but that his 78 album, The Voice of Frank Sinatra, was one of the first concept albums.
It really was. It's arguably the first thematically unified album of popular music in America. Lee Wiley, the great popular singer, had made a privately released thematic album some years earlier than that. But this was the first one that really got out to the public, and it was a game changer.
Let's talk a little bit about Sinatra as an actor, because, again, both Jolson and Crosby kind of set the mold of first you become a singer, and then you go and you make movies. In fact, movies revived the career of Jolson, and Crosby was an Oscar winner in Going My Way, and a gifted comedian as well as a good dramatic actor.
Mm.
And Frank came along and also went into the movies.
Yes, in his own way. He figured he had to get into the movies to advance his career. Everything in his life was in service of his singing career, and it preceded everything. His singing career preceded his movie career. It trumped relationships, friendships, lovers, wives, everything. But I think he, at first he went into the movies in a very calculating way. It was to be an engine of his fame. He wasn't able to do much in movies at first. He signed with RKO, and then when Louis B. Mayer grabbed him, jumped over to MGM, where it seemed as though he was in a sailor suit for about 6 years, trying to keep up with Gene Kelly. He wasn't taken seriously as an actor while he was acting for MGM, and it was really only his breakthrough, which was achieved with huge difficulty and against a lot of challenges, his breakthrough in From Here to Eternity, that established him as a viable screen actor.
If you were to take Sinatra's entire career and look at it and think about acting, records, concerts, radio, and television, nightclubs too. I guess you would include that under concerts, but those are two slightly different things. I think the nightclub dates and the concert dates were sort of different. But of all of those things, which do you think is the primary thing that Sinatra wanted to do?
I think that everything went into those recordings. I think that his great records, Only the Lonely, and so many of those Capitol albums, Swing Lovers, and all the rest of them, that was really just the peak of American popular music. His work with Nelson Riddle, I think he was enormously proud of his work with all the great arrangers who worked along with him. One evidence of this is the fact that when it came to takes in Hollywood, he had a reputation as one take Charlie. When it came to records, he would do as many takes as it took. And on Hello Young Lovers, was it 1951? He did 22 takes. I would argue that for him, the records were everything. He was famous or infamous or renowned among friends and acquaintances for playing his own records when people came over to visit him, and occasionally they were part of his seduction of women. He loved his records. He loved, and it wasn't just narcissism. It was to him the peak of his art.
I remember when Sinatra was a guest on the Tonight Show, and Carson said, Frank, when you want to make it with a broad, what record do you put on?
Well, I'm sure that he wasn't so immodest as to immediately admit the truth, which would have been one of his.
Now, in your book, The Voice, Sinatra, The Voice, you really do try to strip away the myth and the legend. For instance, it turns out there was no horse's head in
Yes.
Harry Cohn's bed. You had
no.
to tell us that?
Yeah, well, Harry Cohn was not Jack Waltz, and Tommy Dorsey was not Les Halley, and Frank Sinatra was not Johnny Fontaine. Listen, The Godfather is a wonderful book, and I knew Mario Puzo a little bit. I spent time with him. We talked a lot about The Godfather and where he got the idea for The Godfather, and some of the fact and the fiction of it. He told me that Don Corleone was based on his own mother, actually. As far as Sinatra's getting out of his contract with Tommy Dorsey, I think there might have been a phone call from to Dorsey from Sinatra's, I won't say his godfather, but his pal, a North Jersey mobster named Willie Moretti. I believe probably unbeknownst to Frank, called Tommy Dorsey and hinted that Dorsey might be happier if he released Sinatra from the contract. But there were also, and this is very unsexy, and it begins to get, but your eyes glaze over quickly when you hear this, there are a lot of lawyers and agents involved, and a lot of legals and ins and outs of that contract, and suits and countersuits, and as far as From Here to Eternity was concerned, no, there was never any horse's head. What there was Sinatra reading this book. It's a terrific book, by the way. Mm-hmm. It was one of the many books I read for
book.
Doing my book, From Here to Eternity by James Jones. Wonderful. It came out in February 51, and Sinatra got it almost immediately and saw this character, Angelo Maggio, a tough little Italian-American from Brooklyn with a chip on his shoulder and constantly downtrodden, the butt of mockery and all kinds of tough words from people who assumed they were superior to him. And Sinatra just identified like crazy with this guy, and he said, I have to play this. Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures optioned the book almost immediately. They called it Cohn's Folly. He paid $80,000 for From Here to Eternity, which was it was unheard of. But he really wanted to make that movie, and Sinatra began sending telegrams to Harry Cohn, to the director-to-be, Fred Zinnemann, to producer Buddy Adler, to everybody who was going to be involved with this movie, and he would sign the telegrams Maggio. Every telegram, Maggio, Maggio, Maggio. He wanted that role so badly. But then Ava Gardner came into the equation, and I think really turned the tide.
In doing your research on the book, you were just mentioning the 25 takes of, or 22 takes. I can't remember what you said.
Young Lovers, yeah.
Were you able to get all those takes? Did you hear?
No, I have a couple of them. I was able to get huge amounts of material from. I was vastly fortunate to have made friends with the great Will Friedwald, the author of the definitive book about Sinatra's music, Sinatra, The Song Is You. Will Friedwald was one of the early readers of my book, and so I felt it was like having this fabulous Kevlar body shield against all the carpers and the completists out in the Sinatra world, because I'm sure I made mistakes, but when you have Friedwald going over your manuscript, you have a lot of protection. Friedwald was incredibly generous and early on gave me a hard drive with many, many versions of many of the songs. I do not have 22 takes of Young Lovers, but I certainly have a couple of them.
It's interesting to hear him doing his kind of outtakes, because the phrasing always seems so natural when you listen to, say, the Summer Wind or something, and then you hear, oh, these 25 takes of it, you think, well, he didn't really have the phrasing down the very first time he did it.
It was hard work. That was one of the huge surprises of doing this book for me, was how very, very hard he worked on his singing. I think he was born with an ear for music. He said late in life that when he was 9 years old, he heard the music of the spheres. I think he really had this almost supernatural sense for music. He certainly had an incredible ear. He was renowned for being able to hear if the fourth violinist had hit a clam, you know, or was a half note sharp. But he worked so hard on his voice, on his breath control, his phrasing and his diction, and he said that diction preceded phrasing in his mind. But it all came together only when he worked very, very hard at it.
You sort of detail in the book how he goes about approaching a song.
He would read the words first. He would read the words, he said, almost as you would read a poem. Before he ever sang a note of music, he would read the words and make sure, first of all, that he was in good hands, that he was in the hands of a lyricist who really knew how to write lyrics, and he was so fortunate in living in an age when there were so many great lyricists, from Johnny Burke to Johnny Mercer, to Cole Porter, to Dorothy Fields, so many great lyricists writing these wonderful words. And Sinatra would make sure that he inhabited that song, inhabited the words of the song, and then he would make very sure that he had the breath to convey entire phrases of that song without taking what felt to him like an artificial pause.
Yeah, he said, "My mother the trombone."
He used to stand at Dorsey's back and wonder where the guy breathed. Was he breathing through his ears? He couldn't figure it out. The guy seemed to never take a breath.
He had a trick.
He did have a trick. He, if you look at just the way a trombonist holds his instrument, his right hand is on the slide, his left hand is over the mouthpiece, and Tommy Dorsey had a sneak pinhole at the corner of his mouth that he covered with his left hand on the mouthpiece, and so he could breathe whenever he wanted to. But as Joe Stafford, who I was vastly fortunate to be able to interview before she passed on, pointed out to me, she said, great singer, one of the very greatest, she said that she, like Dorsey and like Sinatra, had a large rib cage, but that wasn't the whole thing. She said the whole thing was being able to be stingy with your breath, to take small breaths rather than big, deep ones, and that was a talent that she also worked very hard on.
Well, James Kaplan, the book, and it's a marvelous achievement. It's called Frank, the Voice. It's got some fabulous pictures as well as great writing. And I hope that we don't have to wait for Volume 2 for you to come back on From the Bookshelf. When it comes out in paperback, maybe you'll come back and talk.
My promise to you, Gary, is anytime you want me, I'll be there in a twinkling.
Oh, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely and talented Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank James Kaplan, his new book, Sinatra, The Voice. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.